You know, we'd be rich if we could tap into the mind of a fish. Just get that fish to talk and tell us what days you're going to bite.
Fishing is a passion in our region. And fish are one of our most valuable natural resources. People from around the world come to fish in the Great Lakes. It helps our economy, and fish is good to eat.
Fish tacos, fish on the grill. We love that. We're absolute whitefish fans.
From Michigan Radio, this is Swimming Upstream. I'm Rebecca Williams with the Environment Report. Experts who study fish say there are serious threats to the Great Lakes because of invasive species, overfishing, and pollution.
Unfortunately, 99% of society doesn't realize what's going on or care.
The river is a way of life, for fun, to boat ride, to go tubing.
Over the next hour, we'll explore the future and health of the Great Lakes and fish.
Oh, look at the size of that one!
I'm driving, and all of a sudden, wham, from the side, here comes a fish. Wham, from the right comes a fish.
First, the news. From the Environment Report at Michigan Radio, this is Swimming Upstream. I'm Rebecca Williams. The Great Lakes hold a massive amount of water. They contain one-fifth of the world's fresh surface water. In the U.S., there are more miles of coastline along the lakes than along the entire Atlantic seaboard. We think of the lakes today as a great place to play on the beach, to swim, to go fishing.
It's less about the fish. It's more about the place. I mean, the Great Lakes. I mean, come on. We live right on it. We're right in the middle of it.
Those huge, beautiful lakes are changing so fast that the agencies which manage fishing cannot keep up with the changes. On average, a new foreign species gets into the lakes every 7 months. Each could be a threat to the lakes and the fish in the lakes. Some types of fish populations are collapsing, and others are thriving, at least for now. Lester Graham with Michigan Watch opens up our look at fishing in the Great Lakes with a little history.
It's sunrise on Lake Michigan near Grand Haven, and I'm on a salmon fishing boat with former Michigan Fisheries Chief John Robertson.
To go through life and not spend a lot of time out here would be almost a sacrilege, in my view.
Fishing is good today. We're catching Chinook and coho salmon.
That's a good-sized fish.
But Robertson remembers when fishing just wasn't that great on the Great Lakes.
Over on this side of the state, the better part of Lake Huron, there just weren't that much of a sport fishery.
Now, a couple of generations of anglers have been catching Pacific salmon on the Great Lakes. But how did Pacific salmon end up in the Great Lakes? Well, they weren't always there. It used to be in the Great Lakes, the lake trout was the fish to catch. It was big, it was tasty. But by the late 1950s, that fish and others had been severely overfished. And an eel-like blood-sucking parasite called the sea lamprey further reduced lake trout numbers. And those weren't the worst problems for the lake trout. A fish called the alewife invaded the Great Lakes through man-made canals. Lake trout started feeding on the alewives. But alewives caused a thiamine deficiency in lake trout, a lack of vitamin B1. That meant lake trout could not reproduce as well, and the fish became rare. With not enough lake trout to keep the alewife in check, the invasive fish population would grow to immense proportions, and then a food shortage or maybe a harsh winter would cause the alewife population to crash. In the 1950s and 60s, dead alewives washed up on the beaches of the Great Lakes in piles stretching for miles along the coasts. Mark Gaydon is with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission.
If you were living in the Great Lakes Basin at that time and your shorelines were choked with stinking masses of dead fish, would you want to go to the beach?
The Michigan Department of Natural Resources had no idea what to do at the time. In 1964, the agency hired a Michigan native, Howard Tanner. Now 87 years old, retired, Tanner talked with me at his house just outside of Lansing. He says right after he was hired, the director of the agency then, Ralph McMullen, a wildlife biologist, and his deputy, a forester, met with Tanner.
And they just said, you know, we don't know anything about fish, but the fisheries division hasn't done anything in years. Just take it and do something. And Ralph, as I was going out the door, he said, make it spectacular.
Tanner says he saw the alewife as simply food for a predator fish. Something needed to replace the lake trout as the Great Lakes' top predator. His experience as a fish biologist out west told him Pacific salmon would do the trick, and it would be spectacular.
I've got the world's biggest chunk of fresh water, and it's full of food, and I've got a species of fish to put on it. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist. You had to be a fish biologist, maybe. But there wasn't any doubt.
Tanner introduced Pacific coho salmon. His successor, Wayne Toedy, introduced Chinook salmon a little later. Over the course of just a few years, Michigan anglers rediscovered the Great Lakes. People from out of state started coming to the Great Lakes. Salmon fishing caused a boom in tourism. And suddenly, dead alewives were not washing up on the beaches. Howard Tanner says it was just a cycle of boom and bust for the alewife, but people assumed it was the salmon. But the salmon he'd stocked still weren't big enough to eat alewives.
We said, no, that's not true. We must have said that for at least a minute and a half, maybe. And then we said, okay, we did it. And it was serendipity all the way through.
Since the 60s, communities along the coast have become dependent on salmon to attract fishing tourists and their money to the lakes. But it costs a lot of money to keep stocking salmon. Michigan fisheries managers say it's worth every dime. Michigan now spends about $8 million a year stocking salmon and other types of fish. But the Department of Natural Resources doesn't really know how many fish we're catching for those millions of dollars. Gary Whalen is in charge of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources fish hatcheries.
I wouldn't say we have no idea. We would like to have a lot better estimates than we have now.
A Michigan Watch analysis found the cost for each fish caught in Michigan waters ranges from a couple of dollars to $150 per fish caught, depending on species and depending on the year. The Michigan DNR's Gary Whalen questions our estimates and our calculations, and he says, besides, we're looking at it all wrong. It's not about the cost per hatchery-raised fish caught. It's about what those salmon mean to Michigan's economy. Depending on whose estimate you want to use, recreational fishing contributes between $1.5 billion to $4 billion each year to Michigan's economy. And it's the anglers' license fees and federal excise taxes they pay when buying boats and fishing tackle that pay for stocking the fish. Whalen says it's really a good return on investment that's funded by the people who want to catch those fish. But the same reason Michigan and other Great Lakes states really don't have a good number on the value of fish caught causes other problems. They're not really clear how many fish they need to raise in hatcheries to make sure there's enough fish for the anglers without putting too many fish in the lakes. Michigan and other states are now getting some help from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're marking and tagging every fish that's released this year. We caught up with that operation at a federal fish hatchery on Lake Superior. Converted horse trailers are filled with equipment that puts a tiny wire tag on about 60,000 fish a day. Alan Lane is the Fish and Wildlife Service agent prepping things here.
By tagging every Chinook salmon, we're able now to determine how much hatchery production is actually going on.
Not knowing has caused some problems. In Lake Huron, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources has been releasing about 1.4 million Chinook salmon each year, but had no idea how many Chinook salmon were reproducing naturally in the lake. Dave Spratt is a journalist with GreatNorthernOutdoors.net.
These Chinooks were all going into these Canadian tributaries of Lake Huron and multiplying like fiends. I mean, it was clearly way more than the lake could support.
The Michigan DNR now estimates the natural reproduction in Canada could have been adding 10 million to 15 million Chinook salmon each year, on top of those 1.4 million being stocked by Michigan. Lake Huron couldn't handle all those salmon at the top of the food chain. And at the same time, the bottom of the food chain was collapsing because of invasive species such as quagga mussels. For most of Lake Huron, salmon fishing has now collapsed. Quagga mussels were brought into the Great Lakes in the ballasts of foreign cargo ships. Those mussels are filtering out the algae and plankton, which are the base of the food chain. The DNR is now proposing to dramatically reduce the number of salmon it releases into Lake Huron because there's no food for the fish to eat. When the salmon started disappearing on Lake Huron, so did the charter fishing boats, and with them the tourism dollars for the communities along Lake Huron, at about $1 million for each port city. Many charter boats moved to Lake Michigan, where the salmon fishing is still good. C.J. Baker operates a boat for Pedal Jumpers Charters. He moved from Alpena on Lake Huron to Ludington on Lake Michigan. Talking on his fishing boat, he told me he's angry the government hasn't done more to protect fishing, to stop zebra and quagga mussels and other invasive species that stowed away in the ballast of foreign cargo ships.
Because this stuff should be regulated by the feds, and these ships should not be hauling this stuff in here. It's a billion-dollar industry here.
Back along Lake Huron, the restaurants, motels, and other businesses that relied on salmon fishing tourism, couldn't just pull up anchor and move.
The collapse of the salmon fishery out here has been devastating to the area.
Russ Wellman operates Wellman's Bait and Tackle in Aussauble. In the back room of his shop, while gutting some whitefish, he says while many other bait and tackle shops went out of business, he's changed the emphasis of his store, turning it more into a party store, offering snacks and whitefish sausage and fishing lures for other fish still in Lake Huron. The Michigan Department of Natural Resources continues to put about 1.4 million small Chinook salmon into the lake each year, but last year only 1,000 Chinook salmon were caught. Considering the cost of raising all those salmon, that comes to about $475 per fish caught. Wellman says, of course, for the DNR to continue stocking 1 million salmon a year makes no sense.
When they plant these salmon in the river right now, I mean, that's the only small fish that are out there, and that's what the walleyes are eating, you know.
In fact, since the disappearance of alewife and salmon, other native fish like walleye are doing well eating those little hatchery-raised salmon. Jim Johnson is a biologist based at Michigan's Alpena Fisheries Research Station. He says the small towns along Lake Huron have been hurt, collectively losing tens of millions of tourism dollars. Now the worry is whether we'll see the salmon fishery and other Great Lakes collapse.
In Lake Michigan, we're talking $1 billion lost in the coastal communities of that side of the lake if the Chinook salmon fishery were to collapse. Not that it will.
Johnson is quick to stress Lake Michigan is different from Lake Huron. In fact, this year there were more alewives in Lake Michigan, and the salmon fishing has been good there. But fisheries experts are concerned. Mark Gaden with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission monitors fishing across the Great Lakes.
It wouldn't be at all surprising if Lake Michigan and Lake Ontario, for that matter, which are similar as well, would follow the same pattern as Lake Huron.
They're worried that the Pacific salmon that helped make the Great Lakes a world-class fishing spot might disappear.
That was Lester Graham reporting with research assistance from Bridget Bodner.
Huge fish school nearly tips kayak.
I cannot wait for Asian carp.
Something caught. A log? No, walleye.
Mommy, I caught a smallmouth bass.
Step on it. It's a keeper.
The fish is bigger than me.
Six-word fish stories by Tanya Thoman, Mike Gorzin, Shoshana Hurriand, Eli Brush, Karen Flick, and Paige Salomon. This story was informed by the Public Insight Network. Coming up, a story about a fish that can live to be more than 100 years old.
I can't believe that people would, you know, poach them and come out here in the river when they're spawning and catch them and things like that. This is the reason the guard is here.
We'll meet the people who guard sturgeon from poachers. That story in 15 minutes. You're listening to Swimming Upstream from Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is Swimming Upstream. I'm Rebecca Williams. A lot of people love to hate Asian carp. They're afraid if they get into the Great Lakes, they could do a lot of damage. The fish were imported from Taiwan to some southern states where they were used to help fish farming and research experiments. At some point in the 1970s, the carp escaped. They got into the Mississippi River and its tributaries, and they've been working their way up the Illinois River toward the Great Lakes. You've probably seen those videos of carp flying into the air. There are four species of Asian carp. The types of carp that people are really worried about getting into the Great Lakes are the bighead and silver carp. That's the jumper. There are a lot of people who say if these fish get into the Great Lakes, they would wipe out food for other fish, and they would be very difficult to control.
The interesting thing about the Asian carp is that it didn't happen overnight. We've been watching the spread of this fish for decades, actually. And we're just watching.
You ready, Thad? There are fish around. We just saw about four jump out ahead of us.
But once this gets into the Great Lakes, it's going to be spreading out all the rivers that flow into the Great Lakes. And especially, I believe, when it gets to Lake Erie, that's a big, warm, shallow lake. Once those silver carp get in there, it's going to look like a mammoth popcorn maker when a boat starts its engines.
Watch out.
We're seeing hundreds of fish.
Keep your heads down.
My name is Kevin Irons. I work for the Illinois Natural History Survey as a large river ecologist. We're on the Illinois River, about 120 miles upstream of the Mississippi. And we're going out in search of some Asian carp, primarily the silver carp, the ones that jump.
They're jumping probably at least 8, maybe approaching 10 feet. Oh, yeah.
My name is Jerry Rasmus, and I'm retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service after 33 years of working on big rivers all over the Mississippi River Basin.
My name is Reggie McLeod, and I'm editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And I have become known recently as the carp guy.
Bighead and silver carp are constantly eating. They don't really have a stomach. It's just like a mouth and an intestine, and just eat, eat, eat.
And they were brought over here for that reason, placed in catfish pools at catfish farms in the south, and they would help keep the water clean by eating the algae and plankton and kind of filtering out the water. So the catfish would be healthy.
That was a big fish right there. I'd like to have got the net on that one.
And when they brought them over, wildlife officials were concerned that they would escape into the environment and cause problems and displace native species.
You know, they always say, you know, don't let the camel's head in the tent because pretty soon the whole camel's going to be in there.
So there was some debate about it, but the catfish farmers assured everyone that they would never escape from those ponds. But of course, the rains came and floods happened, and it wasn't very long before they started getting out of the ponds and into the rivers, and then it's too late to do anything.
In 1991, we had one commercial fisherman bring this crazy-looking fish into our lab and say, what is this? It was a bighead carp. It kind of looks like a salmon with its head on upside down.
Looks kind of like a spaceship.
So you got a big head and a little body. And these look kind of weird, you know.
It looks like a torpedo, really.
And then we caught, I'll say, onesies and twosies until 2000, where the numbers really exploded. So in 2008, it was the most dominant fish that we caught.
I suspect you could go out there and find all the native critters, but in much, much smaller numbers than were there before.
Our numbers are as low as they've been in 20 years. Things like largemouth bass, bluegill, crappie. We don't like to see an invasive fish come in and change our perception of what our river should be.
That was one just hitting off the side of the boat. That was a big fish. They're jumping pretty good. Look at there. Oh, okay. Oh, that one may have hurt. Oh,
man, you got pummeled.
Right in the crotch.
I think the initial reaction of seeing these jumping carp is to laugh. You know, it's funny. You know, the guy gets hit in the face or in the crotch or whatever. It's a humorous event. Until you realize just what's going on here. Unfortunately, 99% of society doesn't realize what's going on or care. And that's the problem.
I am at war with these Asian carp. Seriously, I don't like them. Never have liked them.
My name's Betty DeFord, and I am the boat tavern manager in Bath, Illinois. This is a small farming community. And the river is a way of life for fun, to boat ride, to go tubing, for entertainment. Because there really isn't a whole lot in this community to do. And kids, they just fish. They like to fish. We were out on a boat and ran into a school of these fish, and they just wouldn't quit. They were jumping out of the water like torpedoes at us. And We thought they were going to sink the 16-foot John boat. When it was all done and over with, after it was beating them out with boat oars, brooms, everything else, and our fists, we had 32 fish left in the boat with us. And that's when we decided to start the tournament to fight the silver Asian carp, because that's the ones that attack you.
I'm going to blow an air horn and wave a shirt. That means the start of it.
It's a competition, but yet it's also to educate the people.
The strategy is not to get beamed in the head if we can.
I'm Kent Dean. I'm from DeCorn, Illinois.
You can have a handheld dip net per person. That's all the fishing gear that you are allowed to have.
Get behind somebody.
My name's Sean Haney. I'm from DeCorn, Illinois.
I'm trying not to get right over here.
Troy Biggs, Murfreesboro, Illinois.
Oh, they wear football helmets with the face grid on them.
Oh, hey, we have a problem, Houston.
I can't drink through that.
The protective gear is not a joke. It is a real thing, because we had a gentleman that had his nose broke and had it cut underneath his eye, and he had to go to the emergency room. They super glued the cut under his eye because he didn't want to be gone from the tournament long enough for stitches. And he come back and finish the tournament with a broken nose and a black eye.
Slow down, kid. Slow down.
You go slowly behind a boat.
Get behind him. Watch out. Watch out.
Follow along the shoreline, and you're going to catch fish.
Basically, what you have is a lot of boats with a lot of people on them in a very festive mood, if you know what I mean, with a lot of nets, and you got them going pretty darn fast down a pretty narrow channel. In very close proximity.
Try to get behind that middle boat if you can. I'm going to try to do it. Crank big boat right on my butt again.
It's like a hell of a wake behind them.
Slow down, kid. Hold on, hold on. I can't hardly control the boat with you on that side.
And the idea is that you want to get in that wake.
Get up in there amongst the fish.
Because it kicks up the fish like crazy.
Oh, look at the size of that one.
I'm driving. And all of a sudden, wham, from the side, here comes a fish. Wham, from the right comes a fish. And, you know, they'll jump out of the water. They'll go across the boat. When you're watching it, here comes another one coming straight forward the length of the boat and just slams right in your chest. And you're trying to recover, but you know you got boats to the left and to the right, and fish slime up to your elbows.
Yeah, baby, here they come.
One, two, three, four, five.
I am proud to say that we have 1,680 fish that will not spawn anymore. I tell everyone at the end of every heat, go back, tell everyone you can think of that could do something to keep these things out of your waters, because once you get them, it's going to be just like it is here. Remember, go back home, tell them you don't want them there. We've known about these things for 10 years. I don't know why nobody else has known about it for 10 years.
It hasn't affected anything important enough to anybody quite yet, I guess. But now I've been hearing talk about Chicago, and that seems to be pretty important. I don't know why that makes it more important than what it has been for the last 10 years, but if that's what it takes to get something done, then so be it.
Asian carp in the Illinois River, working their way to the Great Lakes. That story was produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister. There's a lot of debate about just how big an impact the bighead and silver carp would have if they do get established in the Great Lakes. David Jude is a research scientist at the University of Michigan.
You know, I know some people that think that they're not going to have a very severe impact. And then on the other side of that forum, we hear lots of horrible things are going to happen. The whole entire Great Lakes fishery is going to be destroyed.
He says he falls somewhere in the middle of that range of opinions.
I'm looking at, you know, what impact that they might have. Is it's going to be in the rivers, and they're going to have to go through several bottlenecks, really, to get to the state where they'd be able to produce enough fish to really see the kinds of numbers that would really be disturbing to us.
Jude says Asian carp spawn in rivers, and they need specific conditions, warm water and long stretches of river that are fast moving. He says although there's lots of debate about what Asian carp might do if they get a foothold in the lakes, no one really wants to find out.
We don't want to have exotic species coming in and try to find out what's going to happen, because we really don't know. There's so many trajectories that can happen with them.
He says the invaders that have gotten into the lakes already have shown us that exotic species can be devastating. This is Swimming Upstream. I'm Rebecca Williams. Sturgeon are one of the most fascinating fish in the Great Lakes. They've been around since the time of the dinosaurs. Each fish can live more than 100 years, weigh more than 100 pounds, and stretch 8 or 9 feet long. But sturgeon have also been the target of overfishing and poaching. Dustin Dwyer caught up with one group in northern Michigan that's trying to save them.
So in the spring, I was sitting along the bank of the Black River, way up near Onaway. And I was next to Jesse Hyde, who's lived in this area all his life and watched sturgeon all his life. We were keeping an eye out for sturgeon heading up the river to spawn.
There's one coming up right there. Came up to the top. He's coming back down now.
The long, spear-like fish occasionally poke their heads out of the water like a submarine coming to the surface. We're sitting right next to a deep pool where Jesse says the sturgeon like to spawn. It's not really in full swing yet. If it was, you could tell.
The males, they curl. If you think about it, they're like a torpedo. And they'll curl to where they're like the shape of a banana. And they're really, really quick sideways movement. And it's like a thumping. It's like a drrrr, like that.
Hyde says it's so violent, you can feel it through the ground. Also, get this. If you come across a sturgeon, you can pet it. And it doesn't seem to mind.
Like, say if you grab a tail, they'll freak out. They will. They'll take right off and make a big ruckus. But when you're just touching them and stuff, it don't bug them.
But Hyde says that's also part of the problem. These water giants are a little too gentle. And in the shallow waters of the Black River where they spawn, they're incredibly vulnerable. Hyde has seen evidence of poaching.
One had been killed, and whoever, you know, killed the fish had tied it up. And we found the fish before they actually had a chance to come back and get it.
The survival of sturgeon is pretty important to Hyde and his whole family. His mom founded the Black Lake chapter of a group called Sturgeon for Tomorrow. Every year, the group rounds up volunteers to sit on the bank of the Black River to guard this area as the sturgeon swim here to spawn. For many volunteers, it's a chance to see one of the Great Lakes' most awe-inspiring fish.
It's a unique fish because it's a prehistoric animal.
Jack McAfee is one of the volunteers on guard.
And I can't believe that people would, you know, poach them and come out here in the river when they're spawning and catch them and things like that. But this is the reason the guard is here.
Ann Feldhauser coordinates the volunteers for this river guard. She says sturgeon are extremely valuable because of their eggs.
And a female sturgeon, if it reaches 100 pounds or more, can produce gallons of eggs, which can then be processed and sold on the black market as caviar.
There was a time when sturgeon were pulled out of the Black Lake by the hundreds. Most of it was legal, but there was some poaching too. Now, though, among the volunteers I've talked to, no one has ever even seen a poacher. No one here has to pack a pistol or be ready to fight. They discourage poaching just by being here.
That's Dustin Dwyer. Dustin reported that story from up near the Black River, and he joins us now to talk more about this. So, Dustin, you got to see these fish that have been around since the time of the dinosaurs. What was that like?
It was fascinating. I mean, I had never seen sturgeon before, and I really didn't know that much about them. I had heard some things. But they're just incredible fish. I mean, almost unbelievable. And I have to say, I got to travel all around the state to meet people to talk about fish and do these fish stories. And they're just some great, great people. And it was a lot of fun. But I have to say, not every story about fish in Michigan is fun.
Yeah? How so?
There's the story that I really, really didn't want to have to do, but I really did have to do it. And it's the story about all the pollutants that are building up in our fish. So I met a guy named Joe Bohr, and earlier this year, he got a surprise. He's a researcher for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. He was looking at some numbers for PCB contamination in carp caught in canals in St. Clair Shores. PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, are a group of chemicals that were used in all kinds of industrial products before they were banned in the 1970s. They've been found to cause cancer and other health problems. Bohr says, normally, if you're looking at PCB concentrations in fish, 4 parts per million is pretty high.
But I looked at those numbers, and there was the highest one was 200 and over 200 parts per million. And, you know, that's 50 times higher than you normally see.
It was the highest PCB concentration found in any fish ever in the state of Michigan. The source is still a bit of a mystery, but there are ongoing tests, and health officials have gone door to door to warn people about eating fish from those canals. Luckily, contamination this severe is rare. But here in Michigan, we don't have the luxury to assume all of our fish are safe to eat. We have a history of industrial pollution, and many harmful chemicals find their way to our water and build up in our fish. Corey Gretsch is a toxicologist with the Michigan Department of Community Health. He says before you eat fish, it's a good idea to check the state's fish consumption advisory.
If you follow the fish advisory, we can confidently say that you don't really face any increased risk. If you've been eating more than that, well, it doesn't mean you're going to actually have any negative health outcome, but what you can do is you can talk to your doctor.
But following the fish advisory is easier said than done. The current advisory is about 30 pages of charts and symbols that take you through dozens of types of fish in dozens of waterways. We can make a couple of generalizations. Usually, smaller fish, like perch, are safer to eat. Bottom feeders, like carp and catfish, are more risky. But it can vary quite a bit depending on where the fish comes from, so again, check the advisory. Also, the risk from these chemicals isn't the same for everyone. Women who are or who could become pregnant are at extra risk. So are small children and people who already have health problems. And Gretsch says how you prepare the fish can also make a big difference.
Cutting away belly fat, back fat, taking off the skin, scraping off the gray sort of tissue on that fillet, and then cooking it on a grill or on a rack in some way that lets fat drip away will reduce significantly the amount of these chemicals in that fish.
But even that doesn't work for all of the chemicals. Mercury can't be cut away. Mercury is also unique in another way. Most of the toxic substances in Michigan's fish are actually going down, and they have been for years. But mercury is slowly building up in Great Lakes fish. Mercury can be especially harmful to brain development for babies and children. Joe Bohr from the DEQ says most of the mercury in our fish comes from coal-burning power plants. And while there's been a lot of talk about alternatives, the reality is coal power doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. So if you still hope to be eating Michigan fish 50 years from now, unless there's a dramatic change, Bohr says the mercury numbers won't be good.
I would say it'd be a scary number, where you wouldn't want to eat the fish, right?
At all.
Right.
I'm Dustin Dwyer.
You can find out more about fish consumption advisories for the Great Lakes state you're fishing in on our website, michiganradio.org. Coming up, we'll hear about Michigan's commercial fishing industry and the role of tribal fishing. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Swimming Upstream from Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is Swimming Upstream. I'm Rebecca Williams with the Environment Report. A lot of people depend on fishing for a living, whether it's charter boat captains taking people out for salmon or commercial fishers hauling in whitefish. But when you're buying fish at the store or ordering off a menu, it's not always easy to know where that fish came from. Dustin Dwyer wanted to find out why.
The short answer to that question is Michigan's commercial fishing industry is pretty small. Other than tribal fishermen, only about 50 people hold commercial fishing licenses in the state. Bill Peterson estimates that the number used to be 1,000. Peterson is a third-generation commercial fisherman in Muskegon. I met him on a concrete dock tucked behind a little house near where Muskegon Lake meets Lake Michigan. It's not an easy place to find.
Not too many people even know about us down here.
Yeah, well, there's no sign out front.
Nope, we don't advertise. Sometimes you're better off that way.
The business seems to be getting by fine without it. Bill's grandfather started Peterson's Fisheries in 1927. Bill started young.
Well, I'm 62 years old, and I've been working 53 years.
In that time, he's seen several fishermen go out of business just in Muskegon. He puts most of the blame on regulation. Starting in the 60s, the state put in rules to protect fish populations in the lake, and now the state doesn't issue any new commercial fishing licenses. Peterson says the rules have definitely helped the fish, but the industry is a shadow of what it once was.
Well, there's only two commercial fishermen on this side of the state, from here, Muskegon, to the Indiana border. You've got the whole lake and two fishermen. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It's good business for you, though.
Good for us, yeah. But the fish are just back-to-back. They're thick.
As we talk, the boat chugs in with the day's catch. The catch on this particular day isn't that great. Maybe 1,200 pounds of fish in all. They're packed in green plastic tubs full of ice. The crew hauls the tubs up to the dock. If these guys are lucky, they'll get out of here after a 14-hour workday. And the profit from that work, well, it can vary.
You put in long hours, and sometimes it's low pay. So you either got to like it or be crazy, one of the two.
Well, which are you?
Take your pick.
At least if he's crazy, he's crazy like a fox. The Petersons have managed to keep a fishing business going in Michigan for about 80 years now, while hundreds of other fishermen went under. But for folks who just want to buy fresh local Michigan whitefish, there's a downside. To stay in business, the Petersons stick with just a few trusted distributors. And once the fish gets loaded up on a truck, those distributors send almost all of it to Chicago or New York. From there, the fish gets hard to track.
If someone's listening to this radio piece, how would they know if they're eating a Peterson's Fisheries fish?
They wouldn't.
They would never know.
They would never know. There's no way that you know where the fish comes from.
But that's actually not entirely true. There is one way to know for sure that you're getting a fish from the Peterson family. It's a gray day at the Muskegon Farmers Market. But Amber Mae Peterson is selling the heck out of some fresh Michigan whitefish.
Well, we're based here in Muskegon. My husband's family has been commercial fishing for 75 years. So we sell what we catch.
The vacuum-sealed bags of whitefish fillets and packages of smoked whitefish are disappearing quickly. Peterson's husband, Eric, stands next to her, packing the fish in ice and wrapping it in old copies of the Muskegon Chronicle.
Oh, yeah. It's the only way to do it.
This farmer's market stand marks the first time the family has ever had a retail operation. Talking to Eric, you can see why there was a reluctance. The family has distributors it trusts, and going through them is simple, and it pays the bills. So he says when Amber Mae pitched the idea of selling at the farmer's market, it took some convincing.
I said, okay, go ahead, but I don't want anything to do with it, you know, because I'm not really a people person. But I got into it, you know, and came with her a couple of times, and everybody already knew who I was, so it kind of made me feel a little bit better about working with her, and so I come every Saturday with her.
So she roped you in.
She did. Yeah, she did.
Amber Mae also won Eric over on the name for the new business. That quirky and catchy name is now splashed on a board above their market stall. The Fishmonger's Wife, LLC. She can afford to gloat a bit because, well, the Fishmonger's Wife has been a huge hit.
It just took off. The response from the community was absolutely amazing. People were excited that we were here. And we actually sold out our first Saturday within, I think, an hour and a half it was. It was just crazy.
But success brings its own challenges. Amber Mae says one of her big questions right now is how big can this business really get? At the size they're at now, they're debt-free, and all the fish gets cleaned and filleted by hand.
You know, a fillet machine used is $30,000. And if we had a fillet machine, that would allow us to take and look at doing larger quantities, which will allow us to expand into restaurants and things like that. So, you know, when you're running a business and you're saying, okay, do we really want to do a business loan or not, it becomes complicated.
Complications like that help explain why there aren't more people clamoring to get in the fish business, and why people like me have trouble finding fresh local fish at the store. But the Petersons are making a go of it. The fishmonger's wife is still a pretty small part of the entire Peterson family fishing operation, but it is opening a new door and a new way for the rest of us to enjoy Michigan fish. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
This is Swimming Upstream. I'm Rebecca Williams. In Leelanau County in northern Michigan, a small American Indian tribe has struggled for generations to survive economic and social hardships. The tribe has always been deeply connected to the lakes, economically and culturally. The latest threat to that connection is environmental degradation, particularly invasive species. But the tribes are forming unexpected alliances with old enemies to fight this threat. Shannon Heffernan has this report.
When you first arrive in the Leelanau Peninsula, you think, this is heaven in the Midwest. Lake Michigan stretches out everywhere you look, blue as the Caribbean. It's a place full of second homes and tourists. But there is one spot that is different from the rest. Peshawetown is the reservation for the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, a group that has lived in this area longer than anyone. It doesn't have any t-shirt shops or beachfront mansions. Instead, there are government offices, a casino, and a tribal marina. Ed John is a tribal fisherman who docks his boat here.
I can weld, but I enjoy fishing more because I'm my own boss. I'm not getting rich, and I don't think I want to get rich, but it's working for me.
Tribes have always been dependent on the lakes. We asked Ed how invasive species have been threatening the tribe's livelihood.
I was just telling my buddy, he just called, and they go, got these reporters down here asking us questions about invasive species. And I told him, I says, we've been dealing with invasive species for some time now. First, we got these Vikings coming over and all these other countries actually invading our space.
Ed's wife fishes, and so does her cousin, Bill.
My name is Bill Fowler. I'm a tribal commercial fisherman.
His nickname is Bear.
Because I'm as big as a bear and I work like a bear.
Bill fishes with Jason Sams, who helps haul in the nets. Also along for the ride is Bill's dachshund puppy, Buford.
He eats fish. He eats their faces off them. Oh. The faces ain't worth any money anyway, so. Yeah, he knows there's going to be fish here in shortly, so he's excited.
It takes about an hour to reach the first fishing net.
Come on, fishies. Here, fishy.
Lake trout flop on the dock, bleeding from the gills. Ice keeps them fresh till they get to shore, where Bill sells his catch under the name 1836 Fishing Company, in honor of a treaty in 1836.
I named it that because you know, the treaty is important to us to reserve our rights.
You see, back in 1836, the tribes gave away a huge chunk of land, a third of the state of Michigan. In return, they kept the right to hunt and fish. But much later, in the 1960s, the state of Michigan started heavily regulating commercial fishermen, including tribes, limiting where and how they fished. John Bailey was a tribal leader at the time and says the regulations hurt the tribes.
Economically, it would destroy us, and it would destroy us as Indian people because this is something that in some families has been passed down generation through generation.
Inspired by the civil rights movement in the South, tribes began using nonviolent civil disobedience to protest the regulations. They ignored state fishing restrictions and said to the authorities, come arrest me. According to John Bailey, a lot of whites didn't react well.
One of the groups actually took pictures of Indian fishermen and flooded the state with wanted posters. Spear an Indian, save a trout. And we had guns pulled on us. We had women assaulted.
White commercial and sports fishermen were angry because they thought the nets the tribes used would wipe out the fish. The fight came to a head in 1979 when the tribes went to court. They pulled out that treaty from 1836, the one Bill named his boat after. And because of that, they won. The court said these tribes, they own a part of that lake, and the water and the fish in it too. And that's why tribal fishermen like Bill can still fish today.
A lot of times that people don't realize that treaty right exists. You know, they think of Indians as,
you know, out on the Great Plains living in teepees. And, you know, we're here today, you know, and we're living in a modern way just like everybody else, but yet we're still holding on to our treaty rights.
And that treaty could play a deciding role in the current legal battle to protect the lakes against invasive species. And it's a factor uniting the same groups that were at odds over fishing rights in the 70s.
We got a load coming.
At the end of the day, Bill pulls his boat into the Fishtown Marina. Here he sells his catch to the Carlson's fish shop, owned by a white family that has been in the fishing business for six generations. Bill hands over boxes full of fish that the Carlson's will smoke and sell in their shop. This is a remarkable scene. Only 30 years ago, the Carlson's were on the opposite side of the fight from the tribes. And now here they are, rolling away all of Bill Fowler's fish to sell to tourists. Cooperation like this between white and native fishermen is common now. There are a lot of complicated reasons for that. But the one everyone told us over and over again is this. We have a common enemy, fighting environmental destruction. Jack Nolan is the former president of the Grand Traverse Area Sports Fishermen.
The hard feelings have passed, and now we're working on what's needed today. The Asian carp, all the other invasive species is going on. We don't have any time for bickering. We need to take care of our resource.
Protecting the Great Lakes from the voracious Asian carp is an urgent concern for more than just sports fishermen. Most Great Lakes states are involved in a federal lawsuit. They are trying to get the Army Corps of Engineers to stop the carp by shutting down locks leading into the Great Lakes. But this is where there's a twist. The tribal rights that were solidified in the 1979 court case established that the tribes owned a part of the lake, and others couldn't mess up their ability to fish in it. That might mean that the tribes can do something none of the other fishermen can do, force the Army Corps to shut the locks and keep out Asian carp.
It may be that the treaty rights are the only thing that would protect us. I don't know.
Matthew Fletcher is a law professor at Michigan State University. He says litigating on behalf of the environment is really hard in our court system because the environment doesn't have rights. But treaties, like the one signed with the tribe, are considered the supreme law of the land. Matthew Fletcher, a member of the Ottawa Chippewa Band of Indians, says tribes may be willing to use those treaties on behalf of the lakes because of what they have to lose.
If the Great Lakes tanks and it's all polluted or the water's declined to the point where it's useless, Michigan is still going to be here. But there are about six or eight tribes in the state of Michigan that are going to completely disappear. And so much of the culture and the traditions and the economies, even the language is tied to what the lakes look like. And if that goes away, the tribes have lost in terms of basically becoming extinct.
So far, the tribes have only provided supporting testimony in cases brought by some Great Lakes states to close the locks, a battle that's still ongoing. No one is sure how the treaty rights would shake out in court if tribal members brought a case themselves. But if the tribal rights did hold up in court, it could open up all kinds of doors for using tribal rights to fight environmental battles, from privatization of water to nuclear plants on the shore. And tribes, once at odds with all other fishermen, may prove they have a trump card that could protect the lakes for everyone.
That was Shannon Heffernan reporting with Heather Radke. If you love to fish, you know that a big part of it is just being out on the water with nobody else around. Wading through the river or sitting on the boat, listening to the frogs and the birds, just watching and waiting. But of course, the other part of that game is trying to outsmart a fish. You've probably figured out by now that Dustin Dwyer is a pretty smart guy, but he wanted to get into the mind of a fish, so he met up with a charter boat captain on Saginaw Bay.
There's no evidence that fish understand irony, but if they did, they might find irony in the fact that the people who best understand them are the people who get paid to kill them, or at least injure their lips slightly. And perhaps no one I've met understands fish better than Ed Patnode. He's so good at fishing, I saw him catch one by accident. I climbed aboard his boat, and a few minutes later, a 14-inch smallmouth bass is hanging off a hook he accidentally left laying over the side of the boat.
I didn't really catch that. He was on the line.
Ed's been fishing all his life, and he can tell you things only a fisherman would know. A fish's favorite color, for example, it seems to be pink.
It's crazy, isn't it? It's just nuts, but they love it.
Pink, and also green, and sometimes chartreuse or orange. Ed says out of the thousands of colors of lures they sell in catalogs, he only keeps a few on his boat. It's a charter boat he ties up in Linwood, a small town on Saginaw Bay that advertises itself as Michigan's walleye capital. He decided to start running a charter boat about 6 years ago. Back then, he used to go fishing every weekend with a group of friends.
It got to be expensive each weekend going, and so we were just trying to say, hey, how can we cut our losses? It was really, really, how do we get out there and get other people to help us pay?
And with a lifetime of experience, maybe even obsession with catching fish, he certainly knew enough to do it. But as much as he knows about fish, there's still more he wishes he could know.
You know, we'd be rich if we could tap into the mind of a fish. just get that fish to talk and tell us, why do you like pink? Or can you tell us what days you're going to bite? And what other factors are influencing your decision to bite this pink lure today?
One thing that helps is talking to other fishermen.
Hey, Jeff.
And here in Linwood, there are a number of charter boat captains who are surprisingly helpful to each other. As I chat with Ed, he calls over Jeff Godey, who owns a charter boat called the Michigan X. Jeff's a lifetime fisherman, too. So I ask him, what's the big appeal of trying to figure out a creature that's so hard to figure out?
Yeah, I realized as a kid that I just love to do these things. It hasn't gotten old. You know, I guess that's always a thought in the back of your mind, but... And there's always variety, you know, different weather conditions, different people on your boat, you know, different people to talk to.
He says he's had everyone from old World War II vets to teenagers out fishing on his boat. Jeff tells me his job can be as much about figuring out people as it is about figuring out fish. But let's not try to get too deep here. Fishing is also just a lot of fun. And Ed can hardly hold himself back. Before too long, he tracks down a first mate, fires up the engine... and we go out to catch some walleye. At first it's slow, no bites. But to a charter boat captain, the idea of not catching fish just never enters the picture. Ed changes lures, he changes depths, he changes the speed of his boat. And soon enough, he has me reeling in a walleye.
Get him up. Keep reeling. Keep reeling. It's in the boat.
All right.
All right. Ed gives me a high five. In the excitement of the moment, I forget to check the color of the lure. But I bet it was pink. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
The story of the fish that we love to catch and eat is a complicated one. We've just scratched the surface on the complexities of the Great Lakes and the threats they face. Many scientists say the Great Lakes are at a tipping point. They say now's the time to stop more invasive species from getting in, to clean up the pollution of the past, and to do more to restore fish populations so that future generations can catch them. Swimming Upstream was produced by Mercedes Mejia, reporting by Lester Graham and Dustin Dwyer, with research assistance from Bridget Bodner. Special thanks to WBEZ's Front and Center Project for the report on tribal fishing. The Journey of the Asian Carp was produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister for Long Haul Productions. The six-word fish piece was informed by the Public Insight Network with help from Sarah Alvarez. We also had help from Vincent Duffy. The executive producer was Tamar Charney. Thanks for listening. I'm Rebecca Williams.
Support for coverage of fishery issues comes from the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. This documentary is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan.